For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Epic Virtual Charter School wants an investigation of State Senator Ron Sharp. The school is accusing the Shawnee Republican of intentional misrepresentation of legal guidance given to him by two state agencies and defamation of the school. Sharp has been a major opponent of Epic, raising questions about the legality of its students' attendance practices. Neva, do you think there will be an investigation of Sharp?
Well, I mean, the Senate Pro Tem's office this week said no. At this time, they have no plans for an investigation. So I think this is the ongoing saga of Epic and people like Senator Sharp and others who have been critics and want answers, and this give-and-take exchange that continues to just get hotter and hotter as we go through the summer. And we have interim studies and things going on now at the Capitol, which give further amplification of this issue. So I think it will be something, as we've said before, until there are legal resolutions, if need be, after all of the information is gathered. I think at this point it is going to just continue to be this give and take between all of these very interested parties who clearly don't agree on much of anything.
Ryan.
Well, if you can get past the substance here, you know, whether you think Epic's done something wrong or whether you agree with Senator Sharp, you know, whatever that is, regardless of whatever you think of either party here, just look at the bare tactics. And I think that the tactic that we're seeing here by Epic Charter Schools is a tactic of distraction. I mean, they're trying to shift attention over to some alleged wrongdoing or misappropriation of funds or resources by Senator Sharp. And frankly, you know, he's doing what a state senator does. I mean, whether you agree with him or not, whether you think he's on a wild goose chase or not, he's doing what a state senator should do. If he thinks that there's wrongdoing, he's demanding records. He's trying to hold state agencies' feet to the fire. He's trying to make sure that he's a good steward of tax dollars. And, you know, all of that may be for naught, but the idea that we would go and investigate a state senator for doing that's just ridiculous. I mean, it's interesting that Epic didn't just, you know, they're saying that he's defamed them. Well, if somebody's defamed you, that's a civil case. It's interesting that rather than going to the district court and filing a defamation lawsuit, they went to the Senate President Pro Tem. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, if you file in district court against him for defamation, he's got constitutional legislative immunity. The state Supreme Court's been clear that, you know, what you're doing in the process of your normal legislative acts, you have immunity from that. And then second, if they filed a defamation suit against him, it would open up the discovery process. So all of the documents that Senator Sharp's trying to get right now through Open Records Acts, he's going to be able to get through discovery, including subpoenas and potential deposition of Epic Charter School officials. So, you know, this to me seems more like a PR tactic than anything else.
And Neva, Senator Sharp is a client of yours, but I'm wondering if in a kind of a case of Epic maybe blaming the messenger in this case?
Well, I think as Ryan said, I mean, this is a case of distraction. This is a case of just competing parties who don't agree on anything, that the negativity of kind of this whole discussion just continues to escalate. And I think this is, you know, one party taking a swipe and seeing what the reaction is going to be on the other side. And I agree with Ryan. I mean, there is a course to take if Epic chooses to take that, but it opens up a much wider ranging game than what they're in right now with respect to Epic.
And if you don't like what Senator Sharp's doing here, there's a way to hold him accountable, and that's at the ballot box. Mm-hmm. I mean, what he's doing is exercising his legislative authority. If you don't like the way he's doing that, then you go to the ballot box and you make a case to the voters in that district to, you know, throw him out of office, and then it's up to the voters.
Well, and let's remember, Senator Sharp is someone whose background is in education, yep. A career educator, yeah. in high school, someone who has a great passion for education. So the fact that he would be involved and interested in every type of education issue that's come before the legislature during his time there is not a surprise. So I think that's the kind of the add-on to this exchange that sometimes gets lost in the mix.
Yeah, he's not just a critic of Epic. He's a critic of any school that doesn't
Absolutely.
Feel is doing good to his students.
He's served on the education committee. Yeah. He's been involved. And so this is something that has clearly been his focus from day one when he came to the Senate.
Oklahoma still holds the number two spot in the number of uninsured in the United States. Our state has more than 14% or 548,000 people without insurance. Only six other states have a rate higher than 12%. Ryan, how do you think this will impact the debate over Medicaid expansion?
Well, I think that underscores the strong correlation between underinsured populations and the lack of Medicaid expansion. I mean, you know, out of those six states that were
12% or higher.
12% or higher. Of those states, only one has expanded Medicaid, and that's Alaska. And they've got special circumstances with the delivery of health care and health insurance there that I think, you know, stand them apart from the rest of the nation in terms of comparison. So this is a really strong case that if we want to increase the number of insured people in the state of Oklahoma, the fastest and most expedient way to do that is to expand Medicaid. If we do that, experts say that it will increase health insurance rates by around 200,000 Oklahomans would have health insurance if we expand Medicaid. That cuts that rate nearly in half. And, you know, another key point from the study is that it demonstrates that even though we still have high rates of uninsured people in the state of Oklahoma, we have seen insurance coverage go up as a result of cheaper policies that are available through the exchange under Obamacare.
Ryan. Neva, sorry.
Well, Ryan, that is a key point. I mean, the fact that from 2008 to 2018, I mean, there was much more coverage. I mean, we were at 18.7% back in 2008. So the percentage has changed. But the other element of that is with the Affordable Care Act, it made private insurance more affordable. So even this year, according to the statistics, 150,000 Oklahomans bought private health insurance through the federal exchange. So, you know, again, all of these are debating points when we talk about this bigger picture and this potential for Medicaid expansion to be on the ballot next year. But I think when you start looking at these numbers, I mean, this is something that this legislative working group that's trying to tackle this right now at the Capitol, they have to look at ways, and it's about creating more private jobs with health insurance. It's about figuring out a way to get more federal money potentially, and that's where the rub has been. Do we take the full-blown expansion of the dollars from the feds with the strings that are attached, or do we try to do something different?
Oklahoma is seeing an increase in commutations and paroles. From March through August, the Pardon and Parole Board recommended commutation for 140 inmates, compared to just 10 last year, and 436 parole recommendations, up from 309. Neva, is this coming from new corrections reform laws?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that we can see with the new executive director of the Pardon and Parole Board and kind of this new process. I mean, there's been the creation of the administrative parole function, where just the ability to streamline and bring to the board in a single vote to recommend a batch of inmates that are nonviolent crimes for parole. It gives a much better process to be able to deal with these issues. So at the end of the day, I mean, these recommendations go to the governor, who ultimately gets to make that final decision. But I think we are going to continue to see, through criminal justice reform measures, the laws that have already been passed in Oklahoma, that we will see this immediately showing a difference in the process at the Pardon and Parole Board itself.
Ryan.
Well, and these numbers don't even take into account the fact that the expedited process under State Question 780 retroactivity that the legislature passed last year, and that basically says that if you had a felony conviction under a law that would now be under a crime that would now be a misdemeanor because of State Question 780's passage in 2016, that now you're eligible to have that felony reduced to a misdemeanor on your record. And you know, so that hasn't even taken effect. That takes effect in November of this year. So, I mean, we're going to see even more there. I think that what that says, though, is that we're looking at huge numbers of people that are eligible to be processed differently and treated differently as a result of criminal justice reform efforts. We shouldn't have to have that extra step in there, though. I mean, with State Question 780, there wasn't a retroactivity provision in there. What that means is that State Question 780 looked forward. You know, so if you were charged with one of those crimes, simple possession or a property crime, under a certain amount, then you're charged with a misdemeanor. But if you'd been charged with a felony the day before it went into effect, or even if you'd committed that crime, or allegedly committed that crime the day before it went into effect, then you are charged with a felony. And so what we need is retroactive application or presumption of retroactive application of all criminal justice reform laws. Nobody should be sitting in prison or should have a felony record that just because they happen to be caught and prosecuted before a new reform went into effect. If it's good enough looking forward, it should be good enough looking back.
And I also have to go ask not only the corrections reform laws, but how much is this kind of a shift in attitude as we go away from the strong on crime, the tough on crime attitudes of the past?
Well, I think it's clear. Even Judge Alan McCaw, who retired longtime district judge from Comanche and Cotton Counties, who is the person running these meetings, I mean, he's made it very clear that he wants to make sure that everyone understands that you don't go into these meetings with the presumption that everybody's got their mind made up. And he made the point that, you know, oftentimes in the past there's been that feeling about the Pardon and Parole Board that, you know, the fix was in already, the decisions had been made, and nothing was going to change during the course of the meeting itself. And his position has been very strongly stated in these meetings that he believes that there has been a attitude change that has not only infiltrated the board, but the state, the governor, the legislature, and really, I think, the citizens of Oklahoma by how they have responded and reacted at the ballot box and then after these measures have been passed. So I think that in terms of the inmates, the victims, the prosecutors, the defense lawyers, the whole gamut, I think that they can see what's being stated here is that they want a system that people are fairly heard and respected in that process. And I think you've got people now on the Pardon and Parole Board that clearly are demonstrating that fact.
Ryan, why do you think that? I want to know about the commutations. Yeah. I was 140, that sounded like a really interesting, but only 10 at the same period of time last year. What is the difference there? What is the big jump there?
I mean, I think that one, you're looking at, potential retroactive application of sentencing laws, you know, folks that would not be convicted of wouldn't be convicted of a felony today, potentially a misdemeanor. And, you know, so I think that we're seeing more and more people, you know, taking advantage of that. I mean, some of the laws that have been passed, even under Governor Fallon's administration, that eliminated mandatory life without parole for nonviolent drug offenders. And we saw, you know, people making applications that were sitting in prison for the rest of their life for a drug crime without possibility of parole, going to the governor and seeking a commutation to a life sentence or even something shorter than that so that they had the potential to get out. I mean, we're watching now, and we talk about attitude shifts. I think that the people of Oklahoma are way ahead of their elected officials here. I think elected officials sense that criminal justice reform is important to the people, but I think the people are just even so much further ahead. They're ready for more. And we, you know, this is an isolated anecdotal piece of evidence for this, but Patricia Spotted Crow, recently rearrested, right, woman who 10 years ago was arrested for $31 of marijuana, received a 12-year prison sentence and a 30-year probation on top of that. She was ultimately approved for early release by Governor Fallon, arrested just a few days ago for some technical violations of her parole, probation,
fines.
Yeah. And so the people of Oklahoma stepped up and said, we're going to pay this for. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the deal. She still has 30 years of probation for that. I mean, she's still under the thumb of the state for $31 of marijuana. And I think people are looking at that and saying, this is just ridiculous. And these laws don't really serve anyone in any way, and we've got to change them soon.
House Speaker Charles McCall says he's ready to get started on redistricting efforts. McCall says he will appoint members to committees early next year. Redistricting is done every 10 years based off numbers compiled in the census. Ryan, census day is April 1st of 2020, so is this premature?
Absolutely not. And, you know, I think that, you know, the state is wise to prepare, one, for the census to make sure that we've got as accurate of a count as we can get so that we don't leave anything on the table in the state of Oklahoma when it comes to, you know, the population of the state and after the census. I think that it also means that when we look at redistricting, and there's a possibility that we could have an independent redistricting commission that's created by a ballot measure. But in the event that that doesn't happen, or even if it does happen, being able to begin to compile all of the data and the maps and work towards that process, it's very complicated. It's very technical. And, you know, what I'm hoping is that we've learned so much in the last year as we've watched national cases percolate around the partisan effort to gerrymander these districts and the you know, the patent effort to make sure that one district is preordained a Republican district or one district is preordained a Democratic district. And that just really upsets the very idea of democracy. I mean, if you're a voter and you're walking into the ballot box and just the election's already decided by the very nature of the lines that were drawn, I mean, that's not really democracy. And what we're seeing is when we allow political figures to draw those lines, we're seeing that more and more and more because you've got these consultants that come in behind the scenes to help make sure that that happens. So an independent redistricting commission to pair with what's happening right now is really the way to go for Oklahoma.
Neva.
Well, I think that Speaker McCaul taking the position that that he wanted to move forward with this bipartisan House redistricting committee really kind of along the lines of what was done 10 years ago, that if we all remember, had bipartisan support and was passed, you know, by the legislature, and it had input across the state. I mean, they had 27 members. They broke it out into the five regions, basically kind of along the lines of the congressional districts. They held nine town halls across the state. And I think from what we're hearing from the speaker is that he wants to replicate a great deal of that, believing that it will come up with the best process that will be open and transparent. I think that's what people want. And, you know, it's not just words. They want to see the results of that. And so I'm optimistic that just like we saw 10 years ago, we will have a process that allows, yes, there will always be some in the minority that feel like they didn't have enough input, but the reality is there will be sufficient input, I think, across the board. Now, on the Senate side, the pro tem seems to be taking a little slower track in terms of making a determination how they're going to move. But this process, by and large, I mean, is one that every state recognizes. It's become much more efficient in terms of just the reality of being able to use technology and much more of the streamlined process of being able to deal with the numbers and the math of looking at, in Oklahoma, looking at a state that is very diverse. I mean, when you look at the urban and the suburban and then the rural, I mean, you've got to take all that into account. We have House districts that span, I mean, much like a couple of the congressional districts, span multiple counties. And so that will probably continue to be the case in some of the rural areas, just given population shifts. But I think in the metropolitan areas, especially in Oklahoma and Tulsa counties and the surrounding areas, we're going to see a lot of give and take because the numbers have grown so much in the last decade that population-wise, to get 101 House seats and the 48 Senate seats, I mean, there's going to be a lot of give and take across the board before they get a final lines drawn when the time comes.
And I even mentioned it. The House was very open. It actually passed without any problems. In fact, it was pretty much almost a unanimous decision. There were some no votes, but the Senate went to court time. So the fact that the Senate President Pro Tem is kind of dragging his feet on something like that, does that raise some concerns?
You know, I think that, you know, we talk a lot about wanting to have confidence in our elections. I mean, you know, that was really and I think it was a bogus argument, but I think that, you know, that was really the argument for voter ID laws, is that we want to have confidence in our elections. We want to know that there's integrity in our election process. And I think that when we talk about redistricting and allowing the very people that are up for election to draw the lines by which they'll be determined whether or not they get to run and then, you know, and who gets to vote for them, you know, politicians really shouldn't get to pick their voters. And I think that that does something to talk about the integrity and confidence that we have in elections. I will say this, though, as, you know, as a lot of progressives out there are championing independent redistricting reform as a potential solution for partisan gerrymandering to bring back some confidence and integrity in that redistricting process, I'll say that that doesn't really solve a lot of our institutional problems. I mean, if we really want to look at some of our democratic institutions that are failing right now or in failure right now, we really need to start thinking about things like multi-member districts, proportional representation, and ranked choice voting. You know, those are real election reforms. You know, this is just kind of reshuffling the decks on the Titanic right now.
A Kingfisher business owner is vying for Senator Jim Inhofe's job. Firearms store owner J.J. Stitt plans to run as a Republican for the U.S. Senate seat in 2020. Now, Inhofe hasn't declared whether he will even seek re-election yet. Neva, do you think this will move Inhofe to make an announcement?
I think Senator Inhofe will make the announcement when he makes the announcement. I don't think if one person jumps out there or 10 people jump out there saying they're going to run against him in a primary or a general election, that's going to make any difference in the world. I mean, I think we've seen that in the history of the time that he's been in elective office. And let's remember, I mean, here's someone who was elected in 1994, looking at the upcoming election. I mean, he's raised already $2.3 million. He's got $1.6 million in the bank, no debt to his campaign, no debts. So he's well positioned and can certainly raise much, much more than that if necessary. I mean, he in 2008 in that general election campaign, I mean, he raised over $6 million in a race against Andrew Rice, who raised about half that, $3 million, but still a very competitive race. So, you know, I think Senator Inhofe, like any United States senator up for reelection, takes nothing for granted. And, you know, it certainly kind of signals that we now are in the fall season of folks are going to start to really make their final decisions. Are they going to run in 2020 for whatever office they may be looking at?
The primaries run in July of next year. We still haven't had
June
of next year. Yeah. We still haven't seen a Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a few Democrats that have floated their name out there, but we haven't really seen what we would consider a serious, viable candidate that can raise the $3 million that Andrew Rice raised to make it a really competitive race, whether that's against Senator Inhofe or J.J. Stitt, the Republican nominee. I mean, and I will say, J.J. Stitt's website, jjstitt.com, is fantastic. There's a section on there about J.J., farm and ranch, and when you click on it, it's pictures of cows. No words, just pictures of cows. It's pretty fantastic.
That's the ag vote right there.
And he does have a law enforcement section where he's got a picture of himself with the two United States senators from Texas. I bet that section probably doesn't stay up very much longer because they're probably going to want that down. I'm with Neva. I think Senator Inhofe's going to do what he's going to do here. This isn't going to affect whether he runs or doesn't run. If Senator Inhofe doesn't run, there are going to be candidates of much higher profile than J.J. Stitt that jump into the Republican primary for that race. I mean, in the event that there's a political vacuum, you're going to see every Republican that's ever had statewide aspirations take a strong look at running for United States Senate.
And I think the fact that Senator Inhofe has been fundraising, I mean, giving every appearance of preparing for another race in 2020, that there's no indication that he's thinking about retirement. So, and let's point back, I mean, we talk about the Republican challenger or someone at least that's announced. When we think about back 6 years ago, Matt Silverstein, who was the Democrat that ran, I mean, Inhofe raised $4.8 million and Silverstein raised less than $500,000. I mean, it was not a viable contested race at all. And I think that's kind of where it sets up right now. I think there's no real feeling among the political types, the pundits, or anyone really taking a look at these Senate races across the board for 2020, that this is a race that's going to get very much attention because it's not going to have viable opponents on either side.
Is Inhofe untouchable?
I don't know that he's untouchable. I mean, he's certainly, made himself a national figure and kind of in the way that
a statewide figure, certainly.
Yeah, a statewide figure. But I mean, I think that, if you had a really strong candidate that was running against Jim Inhofe, I think that there would be national interest that would be able to come in. I mean, the financing would be there if you had a candidate that felt like he was vulnerable in some way and that there were political traction in the state of Oklahoma. But if you start to look at the poll numbers right now, that's one of the problems. I mean, if you're out trying to attract money in state or out of state and recruit candidates, I mean, you walk in with poll numbers that show Senator Inhofe starting with such a considerable advantage. It's really hard to imagine who that candidate is and what they would have to do to become viable.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.